UFP, the United Federation of Podcasts.
Welcome to Franchise Fatigue, the little podcast on the United Federation of Podcast Network, where your hosts go over movies, remakes, and sequels. I'm your host, Brandon Shea Mutella, and joining me, as always, is that damn dirty co-host of mine, Zach Moore.
Hey, Brandon. I've never met a Canadian I didn't like.
Awesome. I love it. We're pretty good people. We have donuts. We have moose. It's a good place. I love it. But we're going global. We're going cross-border, we're going cross-ocean for our very special guest. You know, Zach and I knew that when we got to this series of movies, there was only one person that we could have on as a guest. And that's Tom Elliott of the Twilight Zone podcast. Thank you for joining us, Tom. How are you doing?
Oh, Brandon, that's so nice of you to say. Thanks so much. I am excited to talk about some of these movies, at least. I'll be here for part of the journey, but this one especially I had to be here for, so thank you.
Oh, it sounded like you were going to say, I'm excited to talk about some of these movies, but not all of them.
If I was here for all of them, I probably would have still said that as well, yeah.
Awesome. Well, I'm looking forward to this because it's been quite a while since I've seen these movies.
What movies are those, Brandon?
Oh, I guess I should probably say the Planet of the Apes movies. Yeah, we're doing the Planet of the Apes set of movies. This is going to be our biggest franchise to date, isn't it, Zach?
Let's see. There are 5 original movies. Mm-hmm. There is 1 reimagining, as the term was coined for that film. And there is a reboot trilogy. So that brings us to a grand total of 9 movies. Wow.
I'm excited. And we've got a lot of fun movies coming up. I like all these movies in different ways. But what's really cool that I'm really looking forward to on the back end of it is I'm showing this to my older daughter, Aubrey, for the first time. And we're going through the movies one at a time. We're going to watch them. But I've got that Planet of the Apes box set that came out on DVD quite a while ago that had the big Cornelius head. Right? And that. It had all the movies and the remake. That was all that was there was at the time. But it also has the discs for the TV show and the animated TV show. So I'm going to watch those with Aubrey.
I've never seen either of those. So
they're not great. But they're pretty good. I mean, yeah, they're pretty good. So, I mean, it's a Saturday morning cartoon and it's a TV show from the 70s. So,
which has Roddy McDowell in it as yet another ape character. So
he's definitely in it, and I think Mark Leonard does.
He's one of the gorillas in it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think he's like the main bad guy. He's always chasing him. So
he's a Vulcan, he's a Romulan, he's a Klingon, and he's a gorilla.
Genius.
Yeah, I love it. Excellent. Right on. Well, yes, today we're going to be talking about the original classic 1968 film. And the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about my first exposure to the film before we get into our trivia and stuff like this. You know, and this film was introduced to me because of my good friend Matthew. And my good friend Matthew and LaRange loved this movie, and he showed it to us because we were going to be doing an experiment for like social studies or something like that. And I don't know why he picked this. I can't even remember the exact topic we had to do, but we had a bunch of people over and we watched this movie, and going into it I knew the ending, right? Like, this is one of the most iconic endings of all time, and you know, I wish I could go back to and have seen this movie when I didn't know the ending. You know, but of course Planet of the Apes being so, you know, out there in the culture, it's everybody knows how this movie ends even if you haven't seen it, right? And I don't know, I fell in love with it. I thought it was great. I ended up watching the other ones. I think I watched them with him. And this has been one of those movie franchises where I always go back to it. I've always bought the new editions that come out because I love them so much and I want them to be better. I had them on VHS, and then I bought them on VHS and widescreen, and then I bought the big Cornelius Head DVD box set that came out, and then when the Blu-rays came out, they had this weird long book, not quite as bad as the Godzilla book, but for Criterion, but it's a nice big book that has them, and it had the discs in there weird, and it was the five of them. And then, going into the rest of the franchise, I mean, I was working in a movie theater when the remake came out, so I got to see it before everybody else did. And, I never fell in love with it, but I'm looking forward to revisiting it because I haven't seen it in, like, 17 or 18 years. Like, since it came out on DVD, I haven't seen the remake. And then I was working in Lowe's, which is, a home hardware type store.
Lowe's the department store, not Lowe's the theater.
That's right, yeah, Lowe's the department store. And I was being trained when Rise of the Planet of the Apes came out. And so I went to see that in the theaters when that came out, and I fell in love with it. So needless to say, this is one of my favorite movie franchises of all time, and I'm very much looking forward to speaking of it. So I've taken the center stage, but let's jump in on our guest, and then we'll go to Zach. But
yeah, Tom, I'll go last. That's fine. Yeah.
Yeah, that's fine. You're not, you're just one of the chimpanzees. You're not one of the important ones here. Tom, what is your initial experience with this film?
Well, it's funny that you should mention the TV show because for some reason that I can't fathom, that show was huge in England. It kept being repeated and repeated for years. I don't think I was old enough when it first came out to have watched it, but it kept being repeated and it seemed to grow huge in kind of syndication. So I was a massive fan of that when I was little. And then when I got older, Planet of the Apes was on the television. And I thought, great, I'll sit and watch Planet of the Apes. I'm a Planet of the Apes fan. And then I realized I'd never actually watched Planet of the Apes, the film. I was just a fan from the TV show. And the TV show is like one of them gets captured each week and the other two rescue them. You know, it's not a great show. But when you're a kid, you don't care. So kind of like you, Brandon, obviously I knew the Statue of Liberty and all this, spoilers. But I sat and watched it. And even though I knew, the end and blew me away. I've always just kept up with everything Apes ever since. And then obviously with the Twilight Zone podcast, there is the Rod Serling connection. So everything just came together. I'm a massive Planet of the Apes fan. I absolutely love it.
Awesome. It's good to hear. I'm glad, you've covered it a few times on Twilight Zone podcast. You've talked about it a few times. So I'm really glad that you were able to join us for this one. I'm very happy about that.
Thank you, man.
Zach, how about you? What's your experience with this movie?
So yeah, I, like most people who are of a certain generation who were born after the movie came out, I just always knew the ending of this. I'm not sure. Perhaps it was the home video packaging, which has the Statue of Liberty on it. Like, what are you doing? But they've since changed that. I'm saying the Blu-rays that I have, there's no Statue of Liberty on the packaging. So at least there's that, right? But I don't know if it was either the end of Spaceballs or it was like a comic book, perhaps, that I learned the ending of this of. But I remember the first time I saw this, my mom and I rented it from the library, believe it or not. And really enjoyed it as a kid, and then proceeded to rent the other movies through various video stores. I don't think I saw them all in order. I definitely know I didn't see Beneath the Planet of the Apes in order, because when I get to the third movie, the Earth blew up? Did I miss something? What happened? Spoilers, right? So, this was a franchise that I'd watch with my parents, and always enjoyed for various reasons as a kid. It's like, oh man, talking apes and astronauts, and there's all kinds of cool sci-fi stuff going on here. Time travel as well. So they're just throwing in every possible science fiction concept into this franchise they get to one way or the other. And, always a big fan of it. Obviously, the budgets go down, and as does the quality to certain levels as the original franchise continues. And then I was in high school when the reboot came out, when the reimagining came out. That's what Tim Burton called it. He called it a reimagining, and that became kind of a buzzword for people talking about these movies. And that was interesting. I mean, it was budget-wise look great, you know, but I think story-wise there are a lot of holes, and I'm looking forward to revisiting that one as well. It has an ending almost as infamous as the ending of the original for very different reasons. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, for whatever reason, I actually have never seen the reboot trilogy. I was out of college at the time working, and I was like, yeah, I should get to seeing that, you know, and I was just, I don't know, that summer I was really busy and I just didn't see it. And then the second one came out, I'm like, well, I didn't see the first one. And the third one came out, I was like, well, I didn't see the first two. And I'm like, I'm sure at some point I'll get to watching these, because I've heard nothing but positive things about the reboot trilogy. But, you know, there's just so much Star Trek and Superman stuff going around that to occupy my time. I just never got around to it. So this is a great reason to revisit this franchise and for me to finally check out that reboot trilogy. So I'll have a fresh perspective on it when we get to those movies down the line. But yeah, this is one of my favorite franchises as well, in particular the original cycle of films.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. I'm looking forward to your hot takes on that film. Those three of them, all three of them. So excellent. Right on. Well, let's jump into some trivia on Planet of the Apes.
Let's do that, Brandon.
You don't have a lot, do you? There's not much known about this movie, is there?
I mean, it's a relatively unknown independent film. Now, Tom, I know you're the Planet of the Apes expert here, so feel free to jump in and expand on anything. You know, as always, this is a flyover of trivia, because books have been written, many a book has been written about the making of this franchise. I have a couple of these books as well. So,
I got a question before you start. So, since Fox now is owned by Disney, does that make Zira and Nova Disney princesses?
Yeah, just like the Alien Queen is a Disney princess.
Nice.
So, yeah.
Yeah, right on.
So, Planet of the Apes, 1968, the original film. This was one of the first films to have a major merchandising tie-in. People talk about Star Wars, and absolutely Star Wars changed the game, but Planet of the Apes was first. As far as toys and collectibles and action figures and trading cards and books and records and comics, like Planet of the Apes was everywhere in the 60s and late 60s and 70s, which kind of set the groundwork for when Star Wars came out to take a similar path.
Yeah, but did they have Planet of the Apes the flamethrower?
Well, sometimes, that's a Spaceballs reference, right? Like Spaceballs, I'm pretty sure Spaceballs, the end of Spaceballs, parodying this movie, is my first exposure to any of this Planet of the Apes stuff. It's like, what like crawling out of the nose of the vacuum cleaner lady? But anyway, this is based off a book by Pierre Boulle, and who's a French author, and producer Arthur P. Jacobs bought the rights to the novel before it was even published, because he thought it was such a interesting original idea.
I have the book. I've read it. I read it after, like, many years after I'd seen all of them, but I've definitely read it.
No, I have the book as well. I believe it was, well, as is prone to do, it was republished when the Tim Burton movie came out, and my dad got the novelization, the novel that it was based off, and then he gave it to me, and I read it. Tom, have you read the original novel?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of it, to be honest. I like it. Probably as much as this in different ways, you know. I actually did a reading of the whole thing once. Mm-hmm. It took me forever on my Patreon. But, yeah, I'm a big fan of the original book.
Very, a very different story, but also very similar in themes. So we can talk about some of that as we go. But as far as the film goes, Twilight Zone connection, obviously writer, creator, executive producer, host, jack of all trades of the Twilight Zone, Mr. Rod Serling, he wrote the teleplay for this, or the screenplay, I should say. Used to saying teleplay when it comes to Rod Serling, right? But he spent over 30 or 40 drafts trying to translate this to the big screen. Went through several iterations, because in the original novel, the apes are, they're advanced, right? They have like 20th century technology, and that's something, even if you look at the original concept art for this film, kind of the stuff that won over Charlton Heston to sign on is one of the beautiful concept art, and it sold Fox on making the film. Was all these apes and helicopters and computers and in cities, and obviously that was going to be way too high budget. So they ended up deciding to, you know, make the budget down, but put them more like at a, I don't know, like not Stone Age, but, you know, they live in these brick houses, and it's more a more simplified ape society, which makes sense, honestly, to me. In my opinion, I think it makes sense for the timeline of the story. If you're really like, okay, if the Earth blew up in the 80s, you know, 2,000 years later, you know, I don't know, right? But I think it works for this film. So, Rod Serling, though, he wasn't the only writer on the film. Michael Wilson was brought in to rewrite a lot of the screenplay, and his contributions are really seen in the courtroom scene. With Wilson, he was a target of Joseph McCartney's witch hunts of the 50s mm-hmm. about communism, so he infused a lot of that into that scene as well, which was interesting for me to learn because I felt like that was the most Rod Serling part of the movie as well. I was like, oh, clearly Serling wrote this.
Well, the thing is, just to sort of simplify it down for anyone who doesn't know about any of this, mm-hmm. like you mentioned about 40 drafts. I dug pretty deep into this on an episode of the Twilight Zone podcast. And if anyone is not interested in the Twilight Zone, but they like Planet of the Apes, go and listen to that one. It's called Rod Serling's Planet of the Apes originally. But I think you can boil Serling scripts down to three main ones. You've got the first one, which is nothing like the movies that we watch now. Then you've got a second one, which is a bit more like these movies. And then you've got a third one, which is even more like these movies. But what we get in this film, none of these words are Rod Serling's. It's like what ended up happening is, what was the guy's name? Was it Michael Wilson, you said?
Yes.
Michael.
Mm-hmm. He's okay. One of the brothers of Luke and Owen Wilson.
Yeah. He completely rewrote it. So the shape of it is Serling's, but none of the words are Serling's.
Hmm. Okay, interesting. I was always under the impression that the twist ending was Serling's, though. Is that right?
Well, that's what I mean by the shape of it. Yes, that okay, you know yeah. the kind of beats are there, and that is Serling's. But like the words coming out of people's mouths, if you look at those scripts, none of it's Rod Serling's that ends up on the screen.
Because mm-hmm. you've always kind of classified this as the first Twilight Zone, the movie kind of thing, right?
Mm.
In your impression, which is totally is.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think in terms of themes, there's a twist ending and so on, and even some of the stuff we see on screen, how unsettling it is, I still classify it as a Twilight Zone movie, definitely.
Yeah.
I mean, three astronauts find themselves in a fantastical situation. I mean, it's like yeah, so many Twilight Zones. I mean, you know, there are episodes, that, just to you know, talk about that briefly here, there are episodes of the Twilight Zone that really influence this, like I Shot an Arrow into the Air, where there's yes. astronauts that, spoilers, right? The spoilers for Twilight Zone episodes here that are 60 years old, apologies, but astronauts that they go up into space, they don't know, they crash land somewhere, they don't know where it is, they think it's some asteroid. Spoilers, it's in the middle of the desert, and they're back on Earth. And,
oh, whoa, that's a crazy episode.
I know, right? Blow your mind, right? also, other episodes as well. But that is really the main mm-hmm. one, I think, that influenced this one. But you look mm-hmm. at so many Twilight Zone episodes, and it's like two or three guys in a spaceship that find themselves somewhere, and then you kind of extrapolate from there. Plus the twist ending as mm-hmm. well. But there's so much more to this than the twist ending. I think that's part of, and you know, we'll talk about it, right? But I mean, that's yeah. part of the double-edged sword of the twist ending. It's like, oh man, the twist ending. Yeah, but there was so much before that. I mean, yeah. this was like, if you remove the twist ending from this movie, it's still a great movie. I mean, that elevates mm-hmm. it to like cinematic historical, like best movie ever status, that and pop culture iconography. But even if you take that out, it's still an amazing character study of like humanity and all this. But mm-hmm. we'll not to get ahead of ourselves. So one of the biggest stumbling blocks for 20th Century Fox to commit to the project was they were afraid of how the ape faces would appear on screen. Because if people laugh at those, it's like, it's up, right? People aren't sold on the story. They're not going to get invested into it. So they spent $5,000, you know, at the time in the 60s. That's a, you know, sizable amount just for a test scene to be shot with Charlton Heston as Taylor and Edward G. Robinson as Dr. Zaius. And you can actually see this in a lot of the special features and mm-hmm. documentaries. Like this screen test still exists, and you can see. And
yeah, my Blu-ray set that I have, mm-hmm. the whole complete test scene is there. And you know, it's interesting that that's what sold them, because honestly, the ape makeup in those isn't very good, you know?
No, it's very simplified. Like, you don't really have the snout, and it's people go look it up.
They're like Odo.
Yeah, it's very flat-faced. And check it out. It's interesting to compare, like, that's what, it's interesting, yeah, you say that, Brandon, like, that's what sold him. It's like, well, that wouldn't have really sold me, but sure. It was a different time in the 60s, right? So they greenlit it, but they went ahead without Edward G. Robinson. He was replaced by Maurice Evans as Dr. Zaius, because Robinson said he had a weak heart and he didn't think he could endure the makeup putting it on, taking it off every day. I mean, that's an hours long process, and mm-hmm. wearing those prosthetics. Speaking of those prosthetics, the ape actors, they had to wear the mask even during the breaks and in between shots because it took so much time to make them up and take it off. And because of this, most of their meals were liquefied, and they had to drink them through straws. So that's that's an interesting experience for them. And
there's some great footage on the behind the scenes too of some of them eating in front of a mirror with, with the solid food so that they can like make sure to get it right in their mouth without hitting their makeup and stuff.
Mm. Right.
And smoking with those big long cigarette holders as well.
Again, such a sign of the times. Everybody's smoking. Like, well, you can smoke. You got to use the cigarette holders. You can't mess with the makeup. And also just it's kind of a comment on how we think. Right during the breaks, during making the film, lunch breaks and whatnot, the apes, right, the people in the certain apes makeup, they would always congregate with people in similar ape makeup. Like the gorillas would hang out together and have lunch, the chimpanzees would hang out together and have lunch, the orangutans would hang out together and have lunch. So just the subconscious things. I mean, it wasn't like a sign, like, all right, orangutans over here, chimpanzees over here. It's just something that happened, and that's just an interesting note of the production that people like to comment on. Now, as far as the star, Charlton Heston. He was always producer Arthur P. Jacobs' first choice for the part of Taylor. Marlon Brando was a backup possibility. That would have been interesting to see Marlon Brando in something like this. I mean, this is, I don't know what he was up to in the 60s. Like, he was really big in the 50s, and then he disappeared for a while, and he came back for The Godfather. So it's very possible that people think, oh, Marlon Brando, biggest star of all time. I don't know. But let's not forget, Charlton Heston was a huge star at the time as well. And, his name, George Taylor, right? I don't think I realized this till, I don't know, today when I watched it, but the name George is never said in the movie. It's just, it's in the credits. So you just go by Taylor. And I think my entire life, I just thought his name was Taylor. It's like, because that's a first name. I know people named Taylor. That could have been his name. But anyway, George Taylor, they never use first names in the film. They keep it very professional there. So. Now, other stars of the film, Roddy McDowall, he's credited second. He plays Cornelius and other apes throughout the franchise. He doesn't appear till 43 minutes into the film, which is surprising because he's second billed. And Twilight Zone connection there. Let's see, Tom, can I remember? People Are Alike All Over. There we go. There it is.
Well done.
he was the star of that episode from the Twilight Zone. He had worked with Rod Serling in the Night Gallery as well. And but that episode of The Twilight Zone ends with a human being put in a zoo, spoilers, on Mars. So that's another kind of, commentary and that's carried over to this film as far as how people treat, the other, the outsider. Look at that as you will.
Pontifoy
from the Night Gallery pilot. Yes, that's a very memorable character, right? I love Matt McDowell. He's a great actor. And he's really the heart of this. He ends up being the heart of this series, as it continues. So speaking of his character Cornelius, in the Spanish dub version of the film, all the characters keep their original names except for Cornelius, who is rechristened Aurelio. There's no rhyme or reason to that, and I've seen no I don't know what Cornelius means in Spanish. I don't know why they renamed him. This is an interesting wrinkle of his character. Now, part of Zira was offered to Ingrid Bergman, who's a very famous actress in Hollywood's golden era there, but she turned it down, and she later told her daughter, Isabella Rossellini, another famous actress, that it was a big regret for her to turn it down because it would have been an opportunity to work with Charlton Heston and also work, inside makeup and not be known for her face, which she was known for back in the day. So this is a big regret for her. And speaking of that, though, Charlton Heston at the premiere, he met Kim Hunter, quote unquote, met her for the first time, and he didn't recognize her because he'd never seen her outside of her makeup. He didn't know who she was. And Linda Harrison, who plays Nova, she was producer and executive at Fox, Richard D. Zanuck, the guy who greenlit the film. She was his mistress, so that's why she got the part, and she ended up being pregnant with his child near the end of the production, so they kind of had to hide that, And there was also, there was like a deleted subplot at the end, or a plot point at the end, where she would have been pregnant with Taylor's child, but they ended up dropping that because that spins off a whole new, oh, well, humanity is going to start again. And there's all these connotations with that. So they just, they cut that out, and I think that was for the best. Now, in true Twilight Zone tradition, there's a couple of Forbidden Planet props in this film. When Taylor's running around and the apes are chasing him, he goes into the museum. There's a giant claw of a unknown animal that you see many times in that museum, and it's the plaster cast that made the foot of the monster tracks in Forbidden Planet. Mm. So again, this being Twilight Zone, the movie, that's very appropriate. And you think of the Twilight Zone, you think about Rod Serling, you think about social commentary in the trial scene. You think, oh wow, this was so cool that they decided to put this in here, but it was completely ad-libbed on set the day of shooting. It's when Taylor and Zira and Cornelius are making the case for Taylor, and there are three orangutan judges, and they all start doing the see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil thing, and mm-hmm. that was ad-libbed on the day of shooting, and they kept it in the final cut because they felt like it was a little bit of levity that was required because the film was getting pretty serious at this point, so they wanted to keep that in there, and I think that's a good balance. I think this film has a good balance of, like, this is serious issues, plus, but it has, like, a self-awareness, and, mm-hmm. I think Charlton Heston's Devil May Care attitude throughout most of it helps keep everything balanced as well.
Yeah, it's interesting because I never noticed that the first, like, 20 times I saw this movie. I just never noticed it, and it's possible because maybe it was the widescreen. I didn't have the widescreen at the time, but I didn't catch it until it was talked about in the bonus features on one of my previous editions. But watching it with Aubrey, who's 9, she noticed it the first time she watched it. She's like, hey, they're doing that thing. So, and she thought it was pretty funny that they were doing it. So, and I'm like, wow, I can't believe you caught that mm-hmm. as a 9-year-old and on your first watch. So I was pretty proud of her.
Now, a couple of last notes here at the end of the film. One of the most iconic moments in lines in cinema, Charlton Heston, he sees that it's the Statue of Liberty, and he takes the Lord's name in vain, right? He's like, God damn you all to hell. And that was a point of contention in the 60s, but Heston made the case like, hey, look, I'm not taking the Lord's name in vain. I am literally asking God to damn these people to hell because they destroyed the earth. So that is the loophole they got around of pretty risque language in the 60s, especially for a quote unquote family sci-fi film. Right. I mean, I was like, whoa. Right. I mean, like, you see something like it's like in the end of City on the Edge Forever, the Star Trek episode. And Captain Kirk's like, let's get the hell out of here. That's in the 60s. That's powerful profanity. So and finally, in the Pierre Boulle novel that we talked about. Right. There are some differences between the two. The Planet of the Apes, the titular Planet of the Apes in that book, is not Earth. It is what Taylor says that this planet is at the beginning of the film. It's like 300 something light years from Earth, and eventually at the end, though, the Taylor character Ulysses in the novel, him and Nova escape and they return to Earth. But the twist in the novel is they find that Earth, while he has been gone, has gone through the same evolutionary upside downness that happened mm-hmm. here. And then there's another twist at the end of the novel because it's all based off these astronauts in space finding this message that Ulysses wrote. And it turns out the people reading these messages were chimpanzees. And they're like, well, this is silly. Humans aren't that intelligent to write this. And they throw it away. So it's like a double twist. So people mm-hmm. think about the twist ending of the movie, but the novel actually has a couple twists as well. So there you have it. And I do recommend, I recommend Tom's reading of that. I recommend people check out the book. It's just, if you love Planet of the Apes, there's just so much extra cool material out there for this franchise, and there you have it. So there's a flyover of the trivia. We talk for a while here. We could talk 5 times as long and still not even really get into
scratch
it. But there
the
you
surface,
go.
Yeah. Excellent, right on. Yeah, it's such a great classic movie that we can't really add to the conversation. So thanks for joining us.
Yeah, that's really much it.
That's about it.
I do want to say I think we could frame this, and because rewatching it, I realized that there's like four sections of the movie. Right. Mm-hmm. There is the astronauts arrive at the planet and it's mysterious and what's going on. Right. Then there's the Taylor's captured by the apes, but he can't talk. Right. And he's struggling to let people like try and alert people to the fact that he is not like these other humans. Then there's the Taylor on trial. Right. And then there's like the end of like the evidence part, if you will, right, digging into the mystery. So I think those are like the kind of the four parts of the movie. Didn't really strike me like that until rewatching mm-hmm. it for this, and I figured probably the cleanest way to discuss it is maybe if we just kind of move through those four parts so we're not all over the place, if that sounds good to y'all.
I want to talk first about the direction of it. Like, mm-hmm. I love how this movie is directed. Like, the camera angles and, you know, being... While there's some sets, there's also some, you know, out in the open, what do they call it? On-location shooting and whatnot. But what really strikes me during that opening of them being on this mysterious planet is just, it's the tone of it and how mysterious it is. And Jerry Goldsmith's wonderful score for this movie. And, you know, for me, the creepiest thing in this movie and the most iconic thing that I latch onto now in my older age is the scarecrow imagery. That, you know, those big X's, those big X scarecrow imagery. I absolutely love that. And I love that whole sequence of them climbing up the rocks, you know, and them making such use of the widescreen footage by having our, the, you know, the three main astronauts maybe in the bottom right and then like some of the humans chasing them in the top left. You know, they a really great job of utilizing the film and the aspect ratio, you know, tilting the camera in weird angles, looking at things from weird angles, looking at, up at things. It's really, really, really brilliant direction, and I really love it. I don't even know who directed this movie, but, you know, it's just wonderful, and I wanted to call that out first.
I agree totally. I think, I mean, I've got a couple of gripes about the movie, not major ones.
What?
Later on, but I think... But this opening section, the way you quartered it up, especially even before they get to the planet, the way the credits go and the letters elongate and stuff like that, just so kind of... And this is why it feels like a movie Twilight Zone as well to me, because it's just... I think part of it is they're trying to throw you off balance for what's to come later on. They don't want you to know that this is Earth, so... Mm-hmm. They're making all these strange angles, and like you said, the scarecrows and so on, the way the camera zooms out from the spaceship as it sinks into the water, all this stuff. It's like, okay, we want to unsettle the audience, but we also want to keep it clean, and I think they do that brilliantly.
Yeah, it's very disorienting, yeah.
They use a lot of noise and a lot of audio, but also they have those shots of them going down that river, and the camera's taken from way high up, and it's like quiet, you know? Just to show that there's really nothing going on at this planet at this time, you know, and it's just really great. I definitely would love to check out those areas and see those rivers and stuff like this. Do you guys know where that was filmed at all?
I probably did know once and I've forgotten it.
Yeah. I don't know. It's probably somewhere in like Nevada.
Or even maybe Utah. You know, that's what it kind of reminded me of. But yeah, you know, speaking of who directed it, actually, another bit of trivia, right, because there's so much here. But Franklin Scheffner directed it. And he had worked with Charlton Heston before on another film, The Warlord. So Heston recommended him. Originally, J. Lee Thompson was going to direct the movie. He was a he co-owned the rights to this story with Arthur P. Jacobs. Didn't direct this one, but he did come back and direct the final two movies of the first cycle. He directed Conquest of the Planet of the Apes and Battle for the Planet of the Apes. So there you go. But yeah, this let me ask you guys this, because this is something that I've always like not understood, and I think the sequels make this more confusing. Like, what is the mission of these astronauts? I always thought they were always supposed to return to Earth, right? And they're supposed to, this is my understanding of, like, as a kid for years, like, and they go land back in Florida where they should, but the Earth has been completely messed up by nuclear war, and that's why they're in, like, a river or a lake, and they have to trek all the way up, you know, America to go back to New York, and they get taken there, right? But apparently, that was not the case. They were supposed to be on another planet, right? That's what I picked up this time. But then I thought, why are people... rescue missions being sent for them in the sequels. I think the sequels messed up my understanding of what this mission was. Does that make sense? What's you guys' take on that?
I honestly don't know. I mean, it's funny that obviously it depends on what your canon is. There is a book that was released a couple of years ago now. I forget the name of it, but it does fill in a lot of backstory on Taylor, and I think. The fact that the female astronaut was there,
Stuart.
You're right. I don't think the mission was ever that they would end up going back to Earth. I think her purpose was that she was going to have kids.
Yeah, that's what Taylor says later on in the movie, yeah. too. And I was like,
she was
going
to be Eve.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. But then why did the spaceship go back to Earth?
Yeah, why did they go back to anywhere? Because like, when you're watching the mission at the beginning, it looks like a research mission. They're studying stuff, and it's like, okay, we're going back into hypersleep to go back to Earth. So I guess maybe the only thing is that they thought it was they were going to an area where there was a habitable planet, and then realized that they couldn't be, so they had to go back to Earth, or something like that.
Like the computer somehow said, oh, return to base. And I don't know why it did that, so...
Well, I think it's that they were where they were sent to was supposed to have a habitable planet. And then when they got there, they realized it wasn't. And so they had to go home because they couldn't go anywhere else.
So the computer just made this decision for them.
Not the computer. They made the decision to go back.
Oh, okay.
Because, well, where are they going to live? In the spaceship? Well,
it's all very vague, Brandon, is what I'm trying to say. So, also, another point
is... Why do
you
hate Planet of the Apes, Zach?
Also, another point I think the sequel's misunderstanding is... the little, you know, when we see the spaceship that's sinking, right? I always thought like the nose is supposed to be like the nose, and there's like a whole spaceship under there that's sinking. But you see the sequels, and there's like, here's the ship, and it's the little capsule, right? And I did you guys think there was more of the ship to that under the water, or?
I guess, yeah, an original thought, yeah. Yes, that you'd think that there would be more to the ship. Mm-hmm. But we don't really see the ship in space, do
right.
we?
No, we don't. So I just and just think about the size of like what we see of their sleeping pods and the cockpit and the size of that, and they crawl out of it. Like, there's no way that was the whole ship. But in the again, you know, I'm looking forward, right? Trying to understand, you know, trying to make these all movies fit together, some kind of continuity. The ship is like way smaller than it should be. And why are there rescue missions for these astronauts? Oh, they didn't come back. I'm like, of course they didn't come back. You guys knew it. It's established, you know, and they have the clock at the beginning of the movie where it's like Earth time, 1972, or ship time, 1972. Earth time is like when they go to sleep, it's like 2600. And then, of course, when they crash, it's 3970 or something like that, which is, you know, I think 2,000 years is a good amount of time difference for this to have happened, right? What do you guys think about that?
Well, I think, obviously, and you'll see this more as we go, and it's no news to you, but Planet of the Apes is a series that is forever trying to get out of the corner that it painted itself into on the previous movie.
Right, right.
It is a totally reactive movie series, isn't it?
Yes, that's true. Absolutely.
Anyway, these are the things you think about when you watch these things over and over. But
when you've seen a movie 50 times, you're like, wait a minute. But when you're watching it the first time, those aren't the important things that you call out, right? You know, you shouldn't notice things like that on your first watch. I mean, unlike Star Trek Discovery, you shouldn't be noticing problems the first time you watch it.
Well, I'll have to say, I think these issues that I'm bringing up now, it's only in retrospect with the other movies. Inside this original film, everything works. Everything's very smart. I think when they're, you know, they finally get established and they're going down the river, Landon's like, so where are we? And Taylor's like, we're 350 miles away in some constellation of Orion. And then I think Dodge, the one who says, you didn't have time to read the charts. You don't know where we are. So that's in there, right? So it's in the back of your head like, oh, well, they're on another planet. This looks different. Mm-hmm. What's this terrain? Like, there's no people around. There's this weird lightning storm. So they do enough to disorient you. They have a couple lines about how we're somewhere else, but also plant doubt into that explanation. And you don't think about it anymore until, you know, hopefully you're caught up in the story and Taylor's struggle. Right. You don't think about that until the end. You're like, oh, it all makes sense. And that's why the twist works, because they laid the groundwork for it here at the very beginning. And I think, I think that's a good, really smart storytelling there.
So are you saying the rest of the Planet of the Apes movies aren't canon?
Yeah, in my head canon, there's only one movie. But no, I think that's really important. And you think about, you know, talking about the quadrants of the movie here, this is a fourth of the movie. You know, it's like almost 30 minutes in before you see an ape, right? Mm-hmm. You wouldn't even know, right, this, what was going on here. And even the reveal of the gorillas, right, when they find the humans, right, you see them kind of coming through the corn, and you see people on horses, but you don't see what it is. Like, it's a very effective buildup, and then extending by, as you've already mentioned, Brandon, Jerry Goldsmith's score, which is just A+ in this.
Yeah, it's really weird because this is clearly filmed with that reveal of the gorillas on the horses, like that. This is shown this way that you're like, holy smokes, I had no idea this was coming. But I mean, we know that this is called Planet of the Apes, right? So it's it's this weird contradiction. It's almost like it's a, the name of the movie is a spoiler, almost. You know, the way that they filmed it, and it's so brilliantly filmed because you don't see. Really, you can see kind of, but I mean, on a first watch, you don't really know what's going on.
Right.
But once you get that first glory shot of, it's just, it's perfect. And it's like, holy smokes, there's apes riding horses. What's going on here? And here we are, you know, even when I saw this for the first time, you know, 25 years ago, it's like, what a shot. What a glorious, glorious shot.
It is. It is just those things that carry and coming through the field and so on. And yeah, you're right. And people have probably seen a trailer up until this point. So they've probably seen the apes, but it's still really nice the way they kind of lay. I think it's really a perfect movie up until this point for me.
Absolutely. One of the most disturbing things in the movie for me is right here as well. And that's when, you know, they've got the pile of bodies on the ground and they go to take the picture and they start laughing, and just hearing that laugh of like, you know, I don't, just that them taking that picture is like, man, this is really disturbing. And that's what's great about science fiction, you know, like science fiction itself is such a wonderful way to tell stories because you can twist our reality so that you look at things from another perspective. And that's one of the greatest things that this film has done. And, you know, like I'm a Christian, and I remember showing this to a Christian friend of mine, and he's like, I don't want to see this because it's a movie about evolution. And I'm like, it's not a movie about evolution. There's so much more to this than just the concept of evolution. This movie is about war. This movie is about humanity and how humanity treats animals. This movie is about racism. Like, there's so many sub, like, tones and sub themes that are going on in this. And it was so frustrating because the first time I watched it with this friend of mine, and we get to the trial, and they start talking about how apes evolved, and he's like, aha, I told you it was about evolution. And I'm like, were you seriously waiting for that moment? Because yes, obviously that's going to come up at some point, but that is not what the movie's about. We're like over an hour into this movie and you were just like, this is your aha moment that you were right. And it's so frustrating because I'm like, you're missing everything about this movie because you're calling this out right now that this has happened. You're like not invested. And it was very frustrating to have that happen, you know?
Yeah. Do you think that, because for me, that scene, and I know we're jumping ahead a bit, for me, that scene where Taylor is on trial and obviously they follow the teachings of the lawgiver.
Yeah.
And for me, one of the themes is how religion and government should be a separate thing, because they are saying, well, what does the 12th scroll say, Taylor? And he's like, I don't know.
Right.
And they're using that as proof that he isn't, you know, a being on the same level as them because he doesn't know the lawgiver's teachings. So it's a case of, obviously, and this is no downer on anyone who is religious, but why I personally feel the two things should be separate, because, you know, people who are religious in government would then be kind of imposing that on people who aren't necessarily religious. And that's kind of one of the themes for me. So do you think that's what maybe triggered his sort of objection to it at that point?
Probably because, you know, like he's one of those people who are like, you know, when people, I don't want to turn it into that, but he's one of those people who's like, you know, I'm licensed to marry people, and then why should, because I have that license, why should I be able to marry gay people when I don't believe that, you know? And he's one of those people, he's like, he thinks it's the destruction of society and whatnot. He's like one of those hardcore Christian people that are like that. And so there's probably some of that bothered him as well, because that is clearly there, right? Where it's, I agree with you that religion, as a Christian, religion and government should be separate because not everybody believes what I believe, right? So it's really fascinating to see that in the scene, right? But then, you know, we've also got in the scene that this is like, this to me is where kind of the racism comes into it, and where we start to see the racism scene of it, because, like, you know, in the past, people have, you know, like white people have classified black people as being like from the jungle and ape-like and whatnot. And so to see these apes treating a white person like that on screen, it's reversing. They're treating him like an animal, right? Which is like, you know, how white people have treated black people in the past, in the history and whatnot. And like, you know, not just black people, but I mean, that's the kind of what they're going for with this. You know, there's racism everywhere, but that's what I see when I watch this.
Yeah, yeah. One of the interesting parallels, and I don't want to go on it, about it too much, between Serling's version and this version, is that in the original book and in Serling's first draft, the character is called Thomas in those, and when they find out he can talk, he sort of integrates into their society. He's got a house, he goes to parties, you know, he goes for a drink, all this kind of stuff. And it's a lot more of a subtle comment on these themes of racism, and they tolerate him, but they don't fully. It's sort of paying lip service to the freedom that they're giving them. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot more subtle than this, where they're just not even entertaining the thought. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the original, which is why I like both versions, both are valid, but in those original scripts, it's like, yeah, you can live in a house, you can walk around and you can go to bars, but, you know, we still don't really accept you. And I think that, you know, is still very relevant, the kind of false acceptance, which I really like. In both versions tackle it differently, but both are equally as valid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting, you know, that, as you were saying, Brandon, there are lots of different lenses to look at the story they're telling here, right?
Yeah.
You go back, and like in the section where it's Taylor, but he can't talk, which is really genius, right? Because like, let's shoot him in the throat. He can't talk, so he's going to get just put in with the rest of the people. They've already, obviously, the astronauts have taken off all their astronaut gear to take to go for a bath, so they don't have any of their futuristic stuff with them, right? So it just sets them up to be just mistaken for all these other humans. Dodge gets shot, as we see, gets taxidermized later, which is creepy. Yeah. That was like the creepiest moment to me as a kid, right? Seeing them with the dead eyes and stuff. You don't know what happens to Landon, and that's a big reveal in a minute. But that part is, like, that section is like, almost like animal rights kind of thing, because you know because you don't know the apes can talk yet. Again, it's more reveal, right? You see them on the horses, but you're like, but then you see one like taking a picture and like smile, you're like, whoa, okay. That's when they start doing the commentary on like what hunters do, right? Let's just go slaughter all these deer and then hang them up and be like, hey, look at us tough guys here with our guns, and we shot these harmless, you know, people running around. And so, and then we kind of, and then Zira is basically like a veterinarian to some degree, right? She's an animal psychologist. So the way, like, they call him Bright Eyes, the way we name animals, right? And it's the, I mean, they're nice, right? She's very nice to the animals, but still she treats them like animals, right? Like, oh, you want some sugar and all this stuff. And it's just a misunderstanding. But a lot of the other apes are like, oh, God, they stink. Get them out of here. Like, they need to all be, like, Dr. Zaius is like, they just all need to be exterminated, right? So that's the section there. But then when Taylor talks, right, get your stinking paws off me, you damn dirty ape, right? One of the most iconic lines in film, right? That starts a whole new section, right, where Taylor gets put on trial. And that's when it becomes like a civil rights issue, like you guys are talking about, bringing it back around. Right, because you know, in America, for example, you know, black people were not considered people, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's like you talk about things like way into the history books, the Three-Fifths Compromise, and all. You can look all this stuff up, right? The Dred Scott decision. There's so much historical cases that this is drawing from for this you know, right for Taylor to be considered a person. Like, oh, he has no rights under ape law because he's a human, right? And like, oh man, you can see the parallels right there. But again, it's in that science fiction veil. And I think, you know, as a Christian myself as well, I was not offended by this explanation, because, you know, what's interesting is the apes are all wrong about all this, right? They think apes evolved from human. Well, they're wrong too, right?
Because humans
destroy themselves, and that's like a side thing, and you guys rose up, but it's not some kind of evolutionary chain. And it is funny that, you know, I love all the interplay between Taylor and Dr. Zaius, because Taylor's like, how did this backwards civilization get started? And he's like, well, you think it's backwards because you're at the bottom, right? That's why you think that. And it's Zaius knows more than everybody else, right? But he's still wrong, right? Because they think, he's so convinced that Taylor has come from like a secret tribe in the Forbidden Zone, right? And they're going to come take over. But no, he really is an astronaut. But what would you believe if you were these people, right? It's like, okay, like, I don't, yeah, they don't even think flight is possible. Then he makes a paper airplane, right? So there's so much to be said here. Also, the fact that it's Charlton Heston, who was like Mr. Square-Jawed American hero, right? This is Ben-Hur. This is Moses from Ten Commandments, right? This is just, this is the guy that they use to say, you know, you are sub-ape, so to speak, right? Yeah. Subhuman is the parallels here. And then, again, something that people forget entirely when they talk about this movie, I think it just gets, because there's so much going on, they lose this thread when you're just thinking about the movie. Like, Taylor does not like humanity, right? He is very disillusioned. He's very cynical. And, you know, he has a devil-may-care attitude. Like, there's a good conversation with him and Landon at the beginning, one of those classic, I guess it wasn't Sterling dialogue after all, Tom, but it's like, what's your motivation? Right? Where they're all talking, they're talking like, why did you come on this trip? Why did you come on this trip? But then Taylor finds himself in a situation. This is one of the things that attracted Charlton Heston to the role, is like this guy who is very cynical and doesn't like the human race finds himself in a position where he has to defend it. Right.
Yeah.
And that's such a, it's such a unique thing to have to do. And you forget, because that happened so long ago. This, so much has happened. You go on such a journey with this character in this movie. You forget where he started. And I think that's such a cool story conceit, where this guy has to say, no, you know, humans, we weren't so bad, and we're better than you. And in fact, you know what? His cynical, he has this whole journey of like, you know what? Humans aren't so bad after all. I'm going to defend them to these apes. And it turns out he was right in the beginning of the movie, because mankind did make war against his brother and keep his neighbor's children starving, which is some great dialogue at the beginning, right, of his cynical view of humanity. And that's like, whoa, you forget about that, and it comes and hits you, blindsides you at the end with the revelation. So I think Taylor's a great character for a lot of reasons.
It's a cynical view, but it's a very appropriate view, because, like, you know, that is what happens, right? I mean, like, hearing him talk about that, I think about things that are going on in our world right now.
Today. And it's like, today. It's a timeless message here.
Timeless message going on, you know. So, Tom, did you have anything you want to add on this here?
I think you're absolutely right. I love that aspect of Taylor, that rebelliousness, and, you know, that he's done. And I wish I could remember the name of that novel that came out recently. It wasn't great, but it was interesting to see what brought Taylor there, you know. It tells you about his life up until that point, where he's like virtually getting on the ship and he's like, screw this, I'm off, you know. But I think I wanted to ask you what you think of Zaius, because I think he's an interesting character in himself, that yes, he is the villain, but he already knows all this, you know, whether he's been to that cave in the past, but he knows that Taylor was right all along. But he's in this position that he knew they destroyed the Earth, so why would he want them coming back? Because he just sees Taylor and he thinks trouble. So it's like, you know, that's a difficult thing to wrap your head around, that yes, he's the villain, but he has a motive where he actually thinks he's doing what's best for the apes.
Yeah.
But in doing that, he's also denying other beings their rights. So it's got all these levels to it, man.
And Zaius, I mean, like Zach said, that they don't know about flight and stuff. But yeah, Zaius knows all this, because there's like these hidden scrolls that haven't been released and whatnot, that only certain people have access to. And yes, he knows that people were there first. Like you said, people think that they were evolved from humans, and they weren't. But, it leads into the next movies by thinking, when Zaius is thinking that he's from this tribe in the Forbidden Zone, right? But he clearly, going to the second movie, he clearly knows that those people can talk, right? Because when Taylor writes down on the sand, he just
covers it up. Yeah.
Covers it up, right? And he's not surprised by that. And when he sees the floating paper airplane,
crushes it, suppressing
it up,
the knowledge.
Suppressing the knowledge. And, you know, it's not like I've always kind of thought of the lawgiver as like the ape's Jesus, but he's not really, right? Because like the lawgiver is talking about things where, you know, the scrolls that they start talking about, it's like, you know, man will destroy himself. So afterwards, when the lawgiver is writing this, he's like, keep him down, keep him suppressed, because otherwise he will destroy the planet again. You know, which is really interesting.
Because they're not wrong, right? That's the thing. Like, you are on Taylor's side because of, obviously, he is your point of view character. But at the end especially, you're like, oh, wow, well, maybe these apes were right all along. Because you're right, Tom. Like, Zaius is, you know, if there is a villain, he is the personification of that. But he's just trying to maintain their society, right? Even at the end, he's like, I might have saved the future for you, right? When the younger, Lucius, right? He's like, what about the future and all that? And that's the thing. Like, you understand where he's coming from because, yeah, the humans destroyed the Earth. Yeah. So why would you want to – I mean, that's fact, right? So why would you want to kind of, like, allow that to possibly happen again? And that's why this movie is so great, because you, like, you stop and you think about, oh, man, who was right here? Because, yeah, it sucks that they're doing horrible things. Okay, like Landon, for example, that's a tragic character. And there's actually recently came out – a graphic novel called Conspiracy of the Planet of the Apes, and I want to check this out. I haven't seen it, but it's a graphic novel, and it's about Landon's journey on the Planet of the Apes, because remember, he gets separated from the other astronauts, and then by the time we meet up with him again later, we see that he's been lobotomized, right? And Zaius did that, and that's tragic, right? Because I always, that's another one that really creeped me out. It's like finding out what happened to the other astronauts as a kid, that's something that always creeped me out. Because it's like the you know, like any good Twilight Zone story, right? Yeah, Taylor gets isolated, right, and he's completely alone, right? Oh, and Tom has now pulled Conspiracy of the Planet of the Apes off his shelf and is showing me. So you have this graphic novel, Tom.
Have you read it?
Yeah, I'm gonna read the whole thing to you.
Here
right
we
now.
Go.
No, yeah, it's one of the books on my shelf that I haven't read, but I think it's probably going up the list a bit now.
Okay.
One of the least shocking things in my life ever is the fact that Tom owns this already.
Tom, he's the Planet of the Apes guy. That's why he's here. But yeah, that's a whole, like, if they wanted to do a sidequel, like, talk about remakes, let's do a sidequel movie about Landon's journey, because he wasn't shot in the throat, so he started talking. So who knows, you know, how that went. Well, obviously we do now because of this graphic novel, but like his process would have been highly accelerated. Taylor would not have made it as long if he could talk, because he would have been quickly, you know, shoveled off somewhere and then getting lobotomized. That's what's so creepy about this whole situation, and very unsettling. And that, you know, and that takes us to the last fourth of the movie. And I guess
you get there, though, when Taylor does that line, get your stinking paws off me, you damn dirty ape, it's so effective that, like, it's fun because, like, we love these movies so much and we watch them over and over. But watching it with Aubrey, when that happens, you know, she was just like, oh, that's great. Like, she just loved it when he spoke for the first time. You know, like, it's such an important moment. And I turned to her and I said, this is one of the most iconic lines in cinema history. Yes, there's so much about this movie. Yes, the ending is iconic. Yes, the ending is powerful. Yes, the ending is one of the most iconic movie endings of all time. But this is one of the most iconic lines of all time because it's so powerful. And, like, there's times on rewatches when you kind of lose that, because I've seen this movie 50 times. Right, this is one of my favorite movies, but it was such a joy watching with her. I don't think Aubrey knew the ending, but I mean, like, we were talking about it when I knew I was going to watch this with her, right? I kept talking about things like New York and stuff like this, and I'm like, see, do you know what the Statue of Liberty is? I asked her this question like a day or two before we watched the movie, and they're like, yes. And I said, do you know where it is? And she's like, yeah, it's in New York and whatnot. And so, like, I just planted that seed ahead of time. You know, kind of like when we were doing our Battlestar Galactica rewatch, when we were watching it leading up to the end of season 3, I started playing Jimmy all Hendrix. Along the Watchtower. Yeah, like several times leading up so that, you know, she knew the song before we got there, right? You know, so it's kind of fun to do these things with her. I love it. But yeah, that when her reaction to that moment was like, yes. The ending wasn't as impactful for her, but that line definitely.
It's because y'all aren't American, you know?
Yeah. Who cares about the Statue of Liberty? There's one in France. There's one in Paris, right? They're everywhere.
So
on
is
the
he
planet.
In Las
They're
Vegas at New York Casino? Is that where he is? Is that where Ape City is? But no, you go to the last fourth of the movie, or the last quarter of the movie, and I guess if I rewatched Ian here, I guess if I had one criticism, I mean, you know, nitpicking little things here, but I feel like it kind of loses steam in this last section, because they go out to the Forbidden Zone, and Dr. Zaius is following them and stuff, and they, like, capture Dr. Zaius, and they're like, all right, you guys, send the gorillas away, you know, we're gonna shoot Zaius and give us some supplies. So they do that, and they go in the cave, and they have this whole revelation about the would an ape make a human doll that talks, right? The mama. That is a good construction of that doll. That lasted, what, 2,000 years? I mean, I have some toys from when I was a kid. They don't work now, right? Because you know, I hit the Enterprise sound effect too many times on my ship, and the batteries are dead, right? So good on whoever made that doll that says, mama, right? They don't make them like they used to.
Didn't say mama. It just cried. It just went, wah.
No, it said mama. That's the whole point, Brandon. Are you serious?
No, it just cried. It didn't say mama.
Yeah, it totally said mama. It talks. What are you talking about? Help me out here, Tom.
It says mama.
That's the whole point. That's the crux of the thing. Because Zaius is like, this means nothing. My granddaughter plays with human toys, right? Like, if
quit
I had a
rewriting history.
If I had a gorilla toy, it would growl. It wouldn't mean anything. But if it talked, that would mean something, right? So
quit rewriting history, Zaius Moore.
But so they have this, and this is a great, you know, revelatory scene, right? Because Cornelius has had this dig, and they go back to because they've been charged with heresy. So now they have to not only do they have to prove that, you know, Taylor is who he is, but they have to prove to Zaius that they're not heretics. There's evidence for what they're saying, right? But they capture Zaius through this whole thing, right? And then the gorillas come back, and then Taylor has to shoot them off, and they capture Zaius again. It's like a double, like you did the same thing twice at the. It feels like, Tom, you know, you're covering Twilight Zone season 4 right now in your Twilight Zone podcast as of this recording. Mm. It feels like a season 4 episode of the Twilight Zone where they do the same thing twice to pad it out a little bit. So I don't know, did you guys pick up on that at all? You know what I'm saying?
It never bothered me.
I think that's what I was referring to before, that I do think it loses a bit of steam around the, you know, the courtroom stuff and the conversations, but it's all important stuff, mm-hmm. you know. But considering that it's such a ride for so long, and then it gets to this point where it just really slows down, I do think it drags a bit for like the last third, maybe. But it's not so bad that I hate it or anything, you know.
It's an observation, not a complaint. That's what I'll say.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
It's definitely. Just like, didn't we just see this happen? Like, it's just the same situation, but. But that's what seals the deal, right, for as far as Taylor. But the whole time, is it weird that he doesn't think it's weird people speak English? I mean, I know people have said this.
Yeah.
Watching Star Trek my whole life, it never bothered me that this quote-unquote alien planet, the apes, are speaking English. But I guess, you know, they do mention also, you're talking about keeping Earth a secret, they mention they can't see the moon. Perhaps there's some kind of nuclear fallout where, like, there's constant cloud cover, they can't see the moon. You'd think if Taylor would have seen the moon, that would have tapped him mm-hmm. off. But they're, I mean, like, to have people read and write English, would that not be a red flag? I don't know. You guys tell me.
Well, it's funny, and I wish I'd have looked it up for this. Maybe I'll look it up for next time, but Serling actually addressed this in, I think, his second script, so he does mention it. Him and Zira are at this giant telescope, if memory serves, and because obviously it's a more technologically advanced version.
Yeah.
So they're at this telescope, and I'm sure Thomas is like, why are you speaking English? And it's, I think Serling has an explanation for it. I will try and find out what that is next time. But mm-hmm. it obviously doesn't help this movie because, yeah, obviously they're speaking English. And I think they're just trying to brush it under the carpet, aren't they?
Well, it's because English is the most important language in the galaxy. That everybody speaks it clearly.
Yeah,
right?
Taylor being American, it's like, well, of course they speak English. Who doesn't, right?
Yeah, right. Exactly.
But no, yeah. I think they do a good job of hiding it. Because, I mean, as the audience, you're caught up in this journey, right? And at Taylor, right, think about what he's gone through, right? So he's not going to start like, wait a second, right? He's going through so many things that he's just going along with it. But the and that's what this movie, I think, is so great, because talk about the journey, right? We went from a spaceship, right, to a trek across the desert, to like a jungle, mm-hmm. to like a backwards ape city in a cage, to like a human rights trial, and now we're at an archaeological dig, right? I mean, like, there's so many set pieces, and it's just a great, fantastical mm-hmm. sci-fi journey. But Twilight Zone on a big budget, Tom, right? I mean, that's what it's all about.
There you
so,
go.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. It, what's also interesting is you talk about the apes are speaking English and whatnot. I mean, like, it's we did mention the name of the author and whatnot, but, I mean, this book was originally a French novel that was translated, yeah. right? Which is kind of interesting as well. I mean, he wrote Bridge on the River Kwai as well, which I haven't seen that movie. I have it on my shelf, but I've never gotten around to watching it. But, you know, Père Boulle is a very, very famous novelist, and it's interesting to me, at least, that a French novel would have such a huge American impact that it created this American franchise, because, you know, at the risk of saying it, Americans are all about appropriation, and while this is an appropriated movie and they do turn it into he's an American astronaut and whatnot, it is fascinating to me as a Canadian that a French novel would have end up having such an American influence in, or sorry, an influence on America, because America's not always the most willing to, you know, embrace other cultures and whatnot. You know, they don't want subtitled movies and whatnot. So, you know, to have a French book do that, I guess, is what I'm kind of getting at, that I think is very fascinating.
Well, as far as the end goes here,
and
guys,
nobody has anything to add to that.
I didn't want to weigh in on that one, man.
Well, you're from England, from where there's so many cultures in such a small area, right? Like, isn't Europe the size of the States, and there's like, what, 100 different cultures in that area or whatever? I don't know. Anyways, so that's fine.
I just didn't want to stop waiting. Yeah, America sucks, man. All right,
That's not what I mean.
As the tailor in this situation, I'm surrounded by these non-American. I have to say, I have no leg to stand on, especially in the context of this movie, because, you know, America blew themselves up, right? I mean, I assume the rest of the planet is also, you know, in the same state, but they find themselves in New York City. I mean, getting to the end of the film, right? Mm-hmm. I think the reveal here is great, because you're like, what is he going to find? I think it's a great line. Like, Zero's like, what's he going to find? Another doctor? And Dr. Dizzy's just like, his destiny. And he even knows. He's like, don't look for a tailor. You might not like what you find. Because he's like, okay, I think this guy. It's funny because they're all right, but they're also all wrong about all their theories. Mm-hmm. Because Taylor's like, you guys, this backwards planet, but it's your planet. And then Dr. Zaius, he thinks he is from this planet, but he's just kind of confused. And turns out they're all right in their own way. Because, you know, we're traveling along. And we're like, why? Well, this is a long time for people riding on a horse on the beach. This better be a good payoff here. And it's like the best payoff ever. Because even the way they reveal the statue, like it's vague at first, yeah. Right? You see like a torch, and then you see like this pan over, this dolly over, like through the crown of the Statue of Liberty. It's still vague. And I love the 60s and 70s cinematography with these zoom ins, right?
Yeah.
We zoom into Taylor through the crown. He's like, my God, I'm back, right? And we don't see what it is until he has this whole meltdown. By the way, I don't know if you guys ever go to the beach. I've tried this myself. You know how hard it is to pound your fist into the wet beach like he does here? Like, I've tried. That is hard. So good on Charlton Heston for doing that, right?
Well, I don't know, man. I'm 6'6". I know Tom's a big guy, and he's well-built. It's pretty easy for us to do. You're just small enough.
I just need to go to more CrossFit, I guess. But anyway, it's hard to do, all right? So I've tried to replicate this in the movie when I go to the beach. But anyway, like, he has this whole meltdown, and Nova is here the whole time. She's like, just look at him like, what's the big deal, all right? She doesn't know. Yeah. And she looks up confused, and we zoom out, and it's the Statue of Liberty, and it's like, wow, what an ending, because that is so uniquely Earth, right? Because you think about, oh, look, a building, right? Or it's like, whatever, right? Because we've already established there was a human civilization, and I know they went on, like, they had a lot of ideas about what could, like, the reveal be, and it had to be something extremely specific to Earth to kind of drive the point home, because it's already been established that humans are here before, and they could talk, but we needed something uniquely Earth, and uniquely American. And that's why we have the Statue of Liberty. We blew up the Earth, and we're proud of it, damn it. So.
Good old USA. I wanted to add that there's only one thing that I have a problem with in this, and again, it's only because of multiple rewatches, and that is Zaius's line of his destiny, because at that point, like, Zaius doesn't know that he's from Earth in the past, right? So why would it be his destiny if he found the Statue of Liberty, which Zaius clearly knows is there?
It's just a cool line, Brandon. All right, let it go.
I mean, does he not know he's from Earth in the past?
They don't know that at that point, because Taylor doesn't know.
He tells them he's from another planet, right?
He tells them he's from another planet. They talk about it the whole time. Taylor doesn't know that this is Earth until he comes across the Statue of Liberties.
I suppose you could say that he might just think it's a statue of a giant human, because we wouldn't build a statue of a giant ape that big, you know. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's what he's saying. I don't know.
Could be. That's the only thing that
he could find the evidence that mankind destroyed themselves. Because I think even Taylor, like, because Zaius is like, well, if there was a civilization here, what happened to it? And Taylor's like, oh, who knows? Could be a disease, maybe a meteorite. Mm-hmm. The guy who's so cynical about humanity at the beginning is like, well, you know, things happen, right? Like, you know, he didn't. he didn't go to like, oh, well, maybe there was a war and we killed ourselves, because that would have proven the point of the apes, right? So I think Zaius, in all seriousness to your question, Brandon, I think it was like he's going to find evidence that, yeah, mankind blew itself up. And that's what he finds, right? And and I guess the geography, you think about, you know, who knows what nuclear weapons were used to reshape the Earth and the atmosphere and the geography, but it's been 2,000 years. I buy that the Statue of Liberty, Liberty Island kind of floated over, got merged with the mainland, right?
And that's I've always interpreted that it blew up and like the head just landed there or whatever.
Cloverfield style?
Pretty much, yeah. The okay, fine. So you solved it for me, and now I have zero problems with this movie.
Perfect.
This movie's perfect.
I mean, yeah, we could talk, you know, all day about this. But any last thoughts on the film proper here, guys?
I don't obviously want to make light of a very serious situation that we are in the world at the moment, and it's sort of getting ahead of ourselves that in the sequels we find out that people started to keep apes as pets because. Mm-hmm. All the animals died out from a virus. And then I read an article about a cat getting COVID-19, and I was like, oh my God. You know, so it's just, I mean, is that why you chose it at the moment? Because
No, it's not why we chose it. We had it on the long list, and we were thinking, what are we going to do? We had to start canceling the plans that we had for the next year because Ghostbusters we wanted to do got postponed. Right. You know, like all these movies that we wanted to cover got postponed. Bill and Ted got postponed. These were ones that we had intended to cover, and we decided to do the Unbreakable trilogy and then this. And yeah, then this stuff started happening. I mean, like, what was that? Like, I mean, it's funny too, because just recently an article came out where like some chimpanzees escaped from a lab with COVID-19 samples or something
that's
like
how
this.
It starts, man.
That's how it starts. And it's like, whoa. But not only that, I mean, like jumping ahead to, we'll talk about it again, but Rise of the Planet of the Apes, the end credit sequence, as soon as COVID-19 started to spread, I like shared that. And I'm like, I've always believed that the world will end because of a virus or a plague. I've always believed that, you know. I'm not like some conspiracy theorist. I'm not paranoid about it. I'm not a clean freak. I'm not sitting there washing my hands every 10 seconds prior to COVID-19, you know. But I'm like, I always knew that if anything destroyed the planet, it wouldn't be a bomb or whatever. It'd be a disease. And so that end credit sequence in Rise of the Planet of the Apes has always resonated with me. And that's exactly what's happened with COVID-19, you know. So... yeah, it's very fascinating. But yeah, you're right. I mean, the real question is if people can't get enough tests, why are these cats getting tested? But, you know, whatever.
Gosh. No, I thought that same thing, Tom. I always thought that was a weird, you know, get ahead of ourselves with the sequels, but I liked how it was just left the way it was here. They didn't need to delve into too much explanation. It's like, you get the point, right? Taylor has already set us up for, like, mankind is warlike race. The apes are saying that, oh, well, here we are. We're 2,000 years later. Somebody hit the button, and turns out that it's funny how the franchise goes. We'll leave it there about who hits what button when and blows up the earth at that point. But I mean, the whole disease, dogs and cats, apes domesticated, I didn't need all that, right, in the sequels. I thought it was just like, okay, mankind destroyed itself. Apes were left to just take over the earth, because they're on the, if you go through the, you know, the hierarchy of life forms on the planet, dolphins don't have opposable thumbs, so naturally apes would be the ones to take over the earth. So if dolphins had hands, though, we'd all be screwed. So I'll put it that way.
Yeah, and we'll get to it, and I don't know, we'll talk about the sequels, but I love that idea, because to me that just shows, how did the apes become trained? How did they learn to do things? They learned to do things because the humans taught them to do it, because they ended up being their servants and whatnot. I don't know.
Yeah,
I love how this all ties in.
I mean, that happens in the 1990s as opposed to like the 3,500 time, which I think this, you know, the 2,000-year gap is very important here. Like, I think in this film, to set it so far in the future that Earth would be unrecognizable, and this whole society could have risen up in that time with the apes. But we'll get into it. But yeah, I mean, what is one of the most iconic moments and endings to any film is right here. And then I also love how just the waves keep on through the end credits, like the keeps that unsettling feeling, right?
The silence of it, the silence, no music, straight away. It's just silence and the waves. Brilliant.
Well, I hope we did this movie justice. I know that, you know, well, what can you add to the conversation on something like this in this format? But definitely one of the best sci-fi films or best films of all time. So to that point, guys, got a couple questions before we wrap up here. How many times is the Lawgiver mentioned in this movie?
Ooh, Lawgiver. That's a
Lawgiver
good
count. That's going to be our counter on this franchise, because that's what I came up with.
I'll say 10.
10. Okay.
Tom.
14.
14. Wow. Okay, you guys are way off. the Lawgiver is mentioned 3 times.
Okay.
They mention the sacred scrolls a lot, right? And we see it, and we see the statue of the Lawgiver, but that doesn't count cuz somebody says what that is for a while. It's just implied. But to my count, it's mentioned 3 times. First, when Taylor asks Cornelius, like, why do they call this the Forbidden Zone? And he's like, oh, well, it says so in the scrolls written by our Lawgiver. That's the first time. The second is when they're talking to Zaius near the end, and he says that the Lawgiver proved man couldn't be tamed, right? And they're in the cave there at the end. And then finally at the end when Taylor rides off, he's like, I have always known about man, the Lawgiver, blah, blah, blah. And that's the third time they mentioned the Lawgiver, who becomes the one constant thing. That's why I picked the Lawgiver count, because that's the one constant thing in reference throughout all these movies, which are all very different. So it's hard to find one continuous thing. And we end up finally seeing the Lawgiver in Battle for the Planet of the Apes, the 5th film. So played by famous Hollywood director John Huston. So
I don't think they're mentioned in the new trilogy.
All right, well,
the Lawgiver.
No. We'll see.
We'll find out. Excellent. Right on. Well, I got a question for you guys then. How would you rate this movie? So, Tom, let's go with you first. Like, why would you give this 1 star?
So you're not going to pick anything funny and ape-related, like, I don't know, bananas or nothing? Was that too cliche?
Statues of Liberty, Tom. How many?
I would give it 5. No question for me. It's iconic for a reason. Mm-hmm. So because of what it is, but also because of my nostalgia for it, I'll give it a 5.
Mm-hmm. Zach, how many Statues of Liberties would you give this?
Yeah, I give this 5 out of 5 Statues of Liberty. This is, as you said, it's iconic. It hits all the boxes. This is top shelf science fiction, right? Mm-hmm. It's thought provoking. It's
top tier.
It's entertain top shelf. Top shelf science fiction, Brandon. It's entertaining. It's thought provoking, right? I mean, we sit here and talk about the themes and what means what. It applies to who and how and today, anytime, current events across the board, right? And and the performances are great. The special effects are great. I think the makeup still holds up. It's obviously a prosthetic of some kind, but to have them talk and all that, I think it was very convincing. Especially for 1968, you look at other stuff going around that people in, even today, people in gorilla masks and stuff, like, not even handle this. So John Chambers, who made this makeup, A-plus job on this. And if the apes didn't work, the movie wouldn't work, and they do. So across the board, 5 out of 5 Statues of Liberty for me. What about you, Brandon?
Well, I don't know why you guys are rating this movie so low. I give this 10 out of 5. This is definitely one of my favorite movies of all time. So yeah, definite 5 out of 5 for me. I love it, and I never get tired of this movie. I never get bored of this movie, and I could watch it anytime and just be captivated by it, because there's so much glory on the screen. It's just beautiful, a beautiful, beautiful movie. But I got another question for you guys. Tom, we'll start with you. Is this franchise fatigued at this point?
I would say that if this was the only one they ever made, part of me thinks, how perfect would that be? Mm-hmm. You know, just to leave it there and walk away. But as a movie fan, you know, taking away what I know about the sequels, absolutely not. I would love to see more Planet of the Apes. You know, if I was walking into the theater at that time, I would be dying to see the next one. So no. Mm-hmm.
How about you, Zach? Is this franchise fatigued?
This is tough. Right, because it's like such a perfect movie, and it ends like you almost, like you said, Tom, like it would have been perfect just to leave it alone there, and then your imagination fills in like what happens here. Does Taylor restart the human race? Right? Is there some kind of human revolt? What I mean, but you have to distancing yourself from knowing what happens in the sequels. Even so, I would say no, because I feel like there's a lot more to explore on this planet of the apes, right? There's a whole society, or who knows what's going on with the humans at this point. So much of the ape society is yet to be explored. So if they wanted to delve deeper into everything they had set up here, that would be interesting. So no, I will say this franchise is not fatigued yet.
Mm-hmm. And I'll agree with the both of you. Just that last shot, learning that this is Earth the whole time, opens up way too many questions that I want to see answered. You know, so I definitely think that there's room for more on this, and I love this movie so much, and I'm very grateful that we've got sequels to it, and not just because we get to talk about it next time on this episode of Franchise Fatigue. So, Tom, thank you so very, very much for joining us. It's been a blast. This has been a wonderful conversation on a wonderful movie. Please tell everybody where they can find you online.
Well, first of all, thank you so much. You know, this is one of my favorite movie series of all time, and to have the chance to geek out about it with you two has been a great pleasure. So thank you. And if anyone wants to check out my podcast, it's the Twilight Zone podcast at thetwilightzonepodcast.com. And if you're just a Planets of the Apes fan, you don't really care about the Twilight Zone, look up that episode, because if I do say so myself, it's a good one. Rod Serling's Planet of the Apes.
Mm-hmm. Zach, where can people find you when you're not putting your stinking paws on me?
Well, you can find me personally at Moron Zach on Twitter. That's MOOREONCCH. I'm also the host of my own podcast, Always Sold on a Smallville, where we talk about each and every episode of That Young Superman Show. You can find us on Twitter at Always Smallville with one S. And another vote of confidence for Tom's podcast about Rod Serling's Planet of the Apes. That is an A-plus podcast episode. I mean, it's a Twilight Zone podcast is an A-plus podcast, but that's an A-plus episode, Tom. So,
thank you, man.
And Brandon, when you aren't tackling your doctor trying to steal a notepad from them and tell them your name is Taylor, where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Brandon Metella. You can find me over on Trek FM with a show called The Line, which is all about Star Trek Picard. You can find me on the Fandom Podcast Network with a show called Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast, which goes through all of Hitch's films in chronological order. And also, should be out right about a couple weeks from now, something like that. We're not quite sure when they're coming out, but watch for it. Good friend of the show, John Mills, and I are joined by Tristan Riddell for a show called House of Fincher, where we go through all of David Fincher's films in chronological order leading up to his Netflix release, Mank, which should be coming out this fall. So be sure to check that out. Thank you so much to Ken Tripp and Tony Robinson for being executive producers of the network. Thank you so much to Zach Tripp for creating our wonderful theme music. And if you want to give us a rating and review on iTunes or wherever you catch your podcast, we would definitely appreciate that. Helps get us out there, helps get us known out in the galaxy. You know, everybody can listen to us, apes and humans alike. We don't mind. But if you want to support us on Patreon for a couple of bucks a month, for $3 a month, you get early releases. And for $5 a month, you get a audio commentary from Zach and I for a Star Trek episode of our choice. Well, that's all we got for you right now. Until next time, when we cover Beneath the Planet of the Apes, God damn it all to hell.
It's a madhouse! A madhouse!
This has been a production of MTMR Media Works.